Support for IPR comes from Orchestra Iowa, presenting the movie E.T., the Extraterrestrial on the big screen, accompanied by the Symphony Orchestra performing the score live, May 3rd and 4th at 7:30 at the Paramount. Tickets at orchestraiowa.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from IPR News. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we are going to listen to a collection of true stories told in front of a live audience in Iowa City on April 12th. The theme for the evening was The Inside Scoop, and all of the storytellers are journalists. The event is sponsored by Investigate Midwest, the Midwest Center for Investigative Reporting. Investigate Midwest is an underwriter of Iowa Public Radio, and I was the host for the evening.
Tonight is in support and celebration of journalism, and I think it's very exciting that we get to hear from a group of journalists tonight sharing their stories, because so many of my favorite storytellers in the world are journalists. And as a journalist myself, I will say that sometimes it can be really hard to turn off that journalism brain when you leave the office. Every person I meet is a potential source, possible talk show guest. Everything I talk about, read, see, eat, learn, everything is a potential story. And I think that these are attributes that I share with a lot of journalists. And I'm gonna do this one for the young people here. I'm gonna do this TikTok style. Yeah. I'm a journalist. Of course, my curiosity is endless. I'm a journalist. Of course, I'm going to ask you follow-up questions until it becomes socially awkward. Yeah. I'm a journalist. Of course, I'm nosy. I'm a journalist. Yes, you are on the record. I'm a journalist. Your business is my business. I'm a journalist. Of course, I'm not going to get anything done unless I have a firm deadline. Yeah. So often I attribute some of my eccentricities to my vocation. And there's always this question in the back of my head, am I like this because I'm a journalist, or am I a journalist because I'm like this? Yeah. And with this many journalists sharing stories tonight, we just might get an answer to that question. So let's turn to our first storyteller of the evening, a colleague of mine with a story entitled The Last Fisherman of the Arkansas-Mississippi Confluence and Why I'll Never Write About It. Zachary Oren Smith covers Eastern Iowa for Iowa Public Radio. Before moving to Iowa, Zach paddled a canoe named the Water Pony from St. Louis, Missouri to Natchez, Mississippi. Tonight, he takes us to the confluence of the Mississippi and Arkansas rivers to meet its last fisherman. Let's welcome Zach.
If you're lucky, one day you'll make the slow float down the Mississippi to its confluence with the Arkansas River. And if the river's kind, you'll decide to camp there on the upstream corner that rises out of the Arkansas's wide mouth. It's a special place for me. It's home to a story I haven't gotten to share before tonight. Before the Mississippi-Arkansas confluence, the river is wide, requiring a long 45 minutes to cross from one bank to the other. You get pretty good at timing these as you try to avoid your neighbors, the towboats. Tremendous and ambivalent as God, the river is always too wide to feel like an easy passage, but at the confluence, you're reminded how small you really are. If you're lucky, at the confluence, you can sit at its golden bank looking over these two worlds, northwards, the wild and lonely miles and bends of the places that you have been, and southwards, the land of giants, alien and foreboding. But you may not look up the Arkansas River and wonder about its length, the people that must live along it. I was there in 2017. I set up a tent, got a fire going, and was digging into a cup of noodles. I had picked it up from a gas station in Clarksdale, Mississippi a few days prior. It was late, and the water level's descent had left the sun-bittered bodies of many fish across the shore braising in the sun. I'd resigned myself to journaling when a sound interrupted my pungent peace. It was a John boat, small, flat and metal. It settled on a swift arc, landing itself on the bank right beside my intrepid canoe, the water pony. Fearing it was the game warden, I dumped my cup of noodles on the small fire and from my seat tried to kick up some sand onto its embers. On the boat was an old white guy, maybe 5'6". He was red-faced from the ever-present sun, wearing a t-shirt and jeans that must have been blue at some point. He lit a Marlboro light in his mouth, and he took one long drag that sucked the length of the cigarette down to the filter. He flicked it into the river. He reached his hand into the dirty white cooler in front of him and produced a Bud Light from the fins and barbels still live there in the ice, and he cracked it open, took one great draught of beer. Standing aloft his boat, I uncrossed my leg, I put down my diary, and I did what all small animals would do if they spoke the language of their predator. I tried to make friends. The man reached again into his cooler and produced two blue cans. "I'm Bobby Coates," he told me. Coates passed me a beer, and far from the game warden, he fished these waters. He asked if I'd done much fishing on my way downriver, and over again, as I've been working my way down, people would ask, why didn't I fish more? A trot line, they'd say, would keep me fed all the way downriver, but I admitted to Coates, I didn't even know what a trot line was. "You want to see one?" "It's just over there," Coates said, pointing with a freckled arm. And so when I say Coates and I were headed to see the trot line, no, there's no parallel universe where I didn't go into that boat. Bobby and I pulled his boat into a willow thicket upriver on the Arkansas side, and he pried up a piece of line bound there, and with a sharp pry, he undid wads of detritus with the sort of remove one might have while making a pot of coffee. He said, "I'm out here every day fishing about this time, and if I'm not there one day, I'm damn going to be there the next. That's why I like running into people floating downriver." Bobby explained that I wasn't the first canoe he'd met coming downriver. There'd been two paddlers with canoes like me before, multiple John boats outfitted for long travel, a handful of kayaks, and a large raft with a white sail piloted by what Coates called a bunch of Obama voters. He told me I always offer to help them get supplies from town if they need them. It's something I like to do. There are some names we have for things that seem perfectly descriptive. Watermelon, for example, is a melon with a water-like texture. A guitar amplifier is a machine that amplifies the sounds a guitar makes. A trot line, by comparison, is nothing like it sounds. It's a line anchored to the bottom of a river with smaller lines trailing off like tentacles. Each of those tentacles has a hook, and each of those hooks has a piece of bait. In this case, they were all carrying bits of cubed carp. Bobby Coates started from one end and pulled out 15 monstrous fish that bucked around the boat. One fish, perhaps their king, looked up at me from the floor of the boat, one milky green eye darting wildly. It heaved there on the killing floor and blinked as if to say, "Behold the efficiency." That king of catfish began leaping harder and harder around the boat. It found its way onto the white cooler and looked for a second into the dark waters. But thinking better of it, the fish turned to Bobby, as if to say something cutting before making his brave escape. And without an ounce of mercy, Coates took up a club and cracked it. After clearing his line, Coates agreed to bring me to his town to top up my supplies. Maybe it was unnecessary, but I've never been one to turn down charity. As Coates' John boat sped down the Arkansas's dark capillaries, I began hearing loud splashes in the water. "Watch out for aeroplanes," he told me. "For what?" "The fish," he said. A school of Asian carp shot through the air around the boat. The sun was falling, and these fish were made to glitter as they arced through the air. I don't swim. I don't like to swim. But if I did, I hope to evoke the same sort of wonder that those fish evoked in me. Bobby, too, was amazed by fish. And like everything along the river, they carry real danger. The year prior, before cancer took his father, a catfish tore through the air and hit Bobby in his right rib cage. When all was said and done, two ribs were broken, but unlike a foot or femur, there is no casts for ribs, only time. As we made it to the landing, Bobby hoisted the John boat onto a trailer. I got in shotgun, and Bobby cracked open another beer, handed me one. The road curved past us, the levees and planting fields. The road winded past kudzu thickets and tremendous combines. As the sun set, we made it to Watson, Arkansas, Bobby Coates' home. There was a sign out front that says, "Fish sold here." The house belonged to Coates' mom. The place smelled of fryer oil and cigarettes. There at her feet sat two dogs. She told me before her husband died, he and Coates used to fish together. Every morning they'd go out and pull in what trout lines and what a few nets caught. It used to be good business. She went off listing the names of 15 or 20 odd people in the town that caught fish in the confluence with her husband and son. But when the sawmill near Watson closed, she stopped seeing some of them. And when the grain loader stopped hiring, more faces seemed to vanish. The world seemed to get smaller and smaller until cancer took her husband, leaving Bobby Coates, the final fisherman plying this old trade. Later that night, Bobby Coates sent me packing with a drum of frying oil, two of the boniest fish I'd ever seen, and a packet of hot dogs. It was a kindness. The joy of journalism is a chance to bear witness to a people and their story. The power of local journalism, to my mind, is intimately tied to the notion that local people are telling these stories, bearing witness to our lives, our histories. While I was never able to place the story of Bobby Coates, it leaves in me this feeling that the last fisherman of the Mississippi, Arkansas, wasn't hard to find. This was a soul that appeared from the riverside. I wonder about the tremendous lives being lived among us, the ones that are of little interest to the newspapers far away from this room. It's no sin to go undocumented, but I'm telling you, it's no virtue either. And with every headline of a closed newspaper, of its shrunken staff, I think about what's lost. Fewer hands and fewer stories. Thank you.
Zachary Oren Smith covers Eastern Iowa for Iowa Public Radio. More stories to come as we listen to true stories told in front of a live audience in Iowa City on April 12th at the Inside Scoop, a storytelling event sponsored by Investigate Midwest. This is Talk of Iowa from IPR News.
Support for IPR comes from Orchestra Iowa, presenting the movie E.T., the extraterrestrial on the big screen, accompanied by the Symphony Orchestra performing the score live, May 3rd and 4th at 7:30 at the Paramount. Tickets at orchestraiowa.com.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Talk of Iowa from IPR News. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're listening to a collection of true stories told in front of a live audience in Iowa City on April 12th. The theme for the evening was The Inside Scoop, and all of the storytellers are journalists. The event is sponsored by Investigate Midwest, the Midwest Center for Investigative Reporting. Investigate Midwest is an underwriter of Iowa Public Radio. I was the host for the evening.
All right, I want to introduce our second storyteller of the evening, Madeline Ihejerica. She's going to share with us an excerpt from her memoir, Escape from Nigeria, a memoir of faith, love, and war. She retired from the Chicago Sun-Times in November of 2022 after 29 years as a Chicago Chronicle's columnist and staff reporter. Madeline is currently a freelance writer, public speaker, as well as journalism grant manager for the Field Foundation of Illinois. And with war now raging across the globe, one family's story takes you behind the generic headlines to real people, understanding the human toll and what it really is like to live through the horrors of war.
War rages. Gaza, Sudan, Ukraine. War is hell. October 7, 2023, the Palestinian militant group Hamas launches an unprecedented assault on Israel, infiltrating communities near the Gaza Strip. Killed 1,200, mostly innocent civilians, men, women, and children. War rages. Israel launches air and ground offensive to destroy Hamas. Killed more than 33,000, 70% women and children. 1.1 million face catastrophic food insecurity. 31% of children malnourished. In northern Gaza, the region of the territory most cut off from aid, famine is now underway. War is hell. April 15, 2023, civil war erupts between rival factions of Sudan's military government, the Sudanese Armed Forces, and paramilitary rapid support forces. War rages. Killed more than 20,000, conservatively. Displaced more than 9 million in what the United Nations calls the world's largest internal displacement crisis. Khartoum, the capital, home to 6 million people a year ago, today is down to 1 million. The following is from my book, Escape from Nigeria, a memoir of faith, love, and war. My mother's memoir of surviving the Nigerian Biafran War with her 6 small children before arriving in Chicago on June 9, 1969. We were refugees of war. War is hell. The Nigerian Biafran War, July 1967 to January 1970, today ranks as the 5th worst genocide of the 20th century, ending with the starvation and massacre of at least 2 million Biafrans, my tribe, the Igbos. It would be the first time in history that starvation was used as a tool of mass destruction. The chapter, Fleeing from Northern Nigeria, recounts the moment the war breaks out. Nigeria was quick to follow in Ghana's footsteps by gaining political independence in 1960. Although Christopher and I were not personally involved in the politics of the newly independent Nigeria, its effects changed everything for our family. Not too long after the fireworks celebrating independence had been extinguished, the fledgling Nigerian government was rocked by regional factionalism, military coups, and assassinations. By early 1965, sporadic violence had erupted throughout the country. And according to the daily media reports, the targets of the violence very often were Igbos, our people, our tribe. On January 15, 1966, there was a military coup in Nigeria against the federal government. The coup had succeeded in the northern region, where the majority of those assassinated were Yorubas from the north. And it would soon be observed that it hardly took place in the east, where the Igbos lived. Soon, the sentiment would shift and the coup would be viewed as an Igbo conspiracy, heightening ethnic sentiments and divisive ideas. It wasn't long before the rumor spread that the coup was a grand design by the Igbos to eliminate their presumed obstacles and make way for Igbo domination of the whole country. Not knowing for sure where this violence and factionalism would lead, my husband and I began making tentative plans to eventually leave the north and return to our home village in the east. In 1965, when school was over, Christopher sat me down to discuss our future and the plans he envisioned we should follow. "I will need more education in order to get a better job. Perhaps now is the best time for me to finish my college degree," he told me. This decision meant my husband would have to leave the country to complete his university studies. I recall feeling sad that Christopher would soon be leaving our family to go to school. But I was also happy to realize that attending a university in another country or studying overseas would give him a much better opportunity to compete for jobs when we relocated to the East. "Where will you go?" I asked. "I have already been accepted at Furabay University in Sierra Leone," he proudly replied. I nodded in agreement, swallowing back any objections that might stand in the way of the plan that would benefit our family immensely. I wasn't worried about being alone with the children. I knew I'd be able to find the help to care for them. But because Gombe, where we were living, was in a remote part of the strife area going on throughout the country, many Igbos were on edge. Thankfully, Christopher had been thinking about this. "I found out there's an all-girls teacher training college at Zonkwa, near where we used to live," he said. "It's right on the Northeast Railroad. I've already applied on your behalf, and you have been accepted. You and the children will be moving to Zonkwa." Within weeks, we had packed and loaded a truck and were on our way to Zonkwa. The school was in the dangerous northern region, but it was situated near a railroad, a station that could take us directly back to the East should we have to flee. It felt surreal to be making plans based on the possibility of being attacked just because we were Igbo. But that was the reality of the Nigeria that Christopher and I were painfully watching unfolding before our very eyes. Christopher made sure we were settled at the convent before he left the country in December of 1965. Meanwhile, the anti-Igbo sentiment and the political turmoil following the coup continued to simmer, unleashing a tyrannical wave of brutality against Igbos, particularly in the north. The daily media reports about the violence had us all on edge. And in May of 1966, I rode my moped to the market to sell my chinchins, and I noticed there was no one in the market. I instinctively knew something was wrong, based on the persistent rumors of attacks on Igbos that had been coming in from other parts of the north. I was almost certain that a nearly empty marketplace in the town was a sign of impending trouble. My concern was confirmed within hours of my return to the school. The priest in charge of the rectory made an unannounced visit to the convent, urging me and all the other Igbo teachers to just leave everything behind and run straight to the station to catch the 8 o'clock train out of there. He told me a local man had confided in him that his next-door neighbors were plotting to kill all the Igbos in Zonkwa that very night, and that the houses would begin arriving in droves by train at 9 p.m., which was only one stop away and an hour after the last train. At that moment, it was 7. With 8 young children, I knew we would never be able to walk the mile to the station. Thankfully, the priest had already assisted the assistance of a local doctor from South Africa who loaded us all onto a truck and drove us to the station. I was unprepared for the scene that awaited us upon arrival. The station was teeming with hundreds and hundreds of elderly, adults, children. All were determined to get aboard that last train. The train pulled into the station and a pushing and a shoving immediately commenced. Everyone was running to get onto that train. I ran, grabbing my children, dragging them along behind me. I got 4 of them onto the train with me and looked around for the other 2. I looked out the window and there they were, still standing on the platform. There was no more room on the train. The train was about to take off. I had to make a decision. Do I get off this train and die with all my children, or do I allow 2 of my children to die? As I contemplated my options, God placed an angel in my path. Suddenly, the station master ran over and threw my 2 children into the train's windows. I started nervously trying to squeeze past everyone, calling their names. "Winifred, yes, Ma, Christopher, Ma, Francis, where are you?" Hearing my voice, they followed me to where I was on the train, and we all sat on the piles of luggage in the cramped, smothering quarters of the train. And as we pulled off, seared in my memory were the faces of hundreds and hundreds of men, women, children, and elderly who walked away from the train edge and sat to await their fate. I would learn later that the Hausas entered Zankua and came to the school looking for the Igbo teachers. I would also hear stories about the massacre that occurred and the rapes. I don't know what happened to the Igbo students at the school or to the Igbo station master who stood on the platform after helping me get my children into the train. The trip was treacherously long for most of the people on the train, particularly for those who had boarded before Zankua. They had already been on the train for about 2 days when my family squeezed on. There was no legroom anywhere, and pregnant women and the elderly suffered with swollen limbs. Children cried, the elders moaned, and there were nervous screams and a general feeling of despair all around. The train was stuffy and hot as an oven, and at every station, bodies of people who had died as a result of the overcrowding were simply tossed from the train, eliciting from the weary passengers and their relatives sorrowful, mournful wails. As the train rolled across the countryside, I suddenly had a frightening thought. What if Christopher should return to Zankua looking for us? I pushed it away. I had to focus on the immediate concerns. We were headed back to the place where we were from, but we had no house. It would be my sole responsibility to put food on the table for my children, find them shelter, and ensure their safety amidst death all around us. Fear was not an option. Like Biafra and all other wars before and after, war is hell. The true measure of Gaza, Sudan, Ukraine is not politics, but bodies. There are certain building blocks that require agreement for any society to work. We must know, we must acknowledge truth. War is hell. And that is the most basic cornerstone of the reality we must all push to change. Thank you for listening.
Madeline Ihedjerica. She is the author, along with her mother, Angelina Ihedjerica, of Escape from Nigeria, a memoir of faith, love, and war. You're listening to The Inside Scoop, a storytelling event from Investigate Midwest on Talk of Iowa from IPR News.
Our next storyteller, she's got all of our backs, is Lee Rood. She's going to tell a story called The Story Behind My Story. She's an investigative reporter and Reader's Watchdog columnist at the Des Moines Register. Rood created the Watchdog column in 2012 to find answers and bring accountability to readers on a range of topics. During her career, she has investigated serious concerns brought to her by Iowans, and this is a story about her father, who is also a journalist. Let's welcome Lee Rood.
Okay, so it's my first day and my very first journalism class at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. And the professor's going around the room asking all the young journalists where they're from and what they want to do when they grow up. And I'm impressed because some of these kids say they want to follow in the footsteps of Woodward and Bernstein. Some know the work of Seymour Hersh, a famous investigative reporter. One guy has the chutzpah to say he wants to be a novelist. But when the professor gets to me, sitting in the very back of class, I don't get a chance to speak. Instead, he says, her daddy won a Pulitzer. Now she thinks she's gonna win one too. All my life, I never wanted anything but to be a journalist. But I didn't realize until that very moment, I had no idea what I was getting into. My dad and his colleagues did win a Pulitzer at the Omaha Sun newspapers. It was for an expose on Boys Town, the secret wealth amassed by Boys Town, a Nebraska youth home that was made popular by a 1938 movie. He was just 29 years old when that happened, the same year that the Washington Post won a Pulitzer for Watergate. But what that professor didn't know is that my dad moved to Washington shortly after to cover Congress. And so every summer after that, my brother, who was 10, and me, I was 8, and our younger brother, who was 3, would fly off from Omaha to Washington to go see him in the summers. And while he was never very far from a yellow legal pad or a typewriter, our image of what journalism was shaped not so much by what he was covering at the time, but by our dad and his friends, the people who made up our little world. And our dad didn't really fit in Washington. He had this thick caterpillar mustache and long black ponytail way after they were popular. In the late 1970s, his signature look were purple polyester pants, a tune-in tavern t-shirt, and holy Converse tennis shoes. In Washington, he was known for asking pointed, often uncomfortable questions. One time, the editor of the Washington Monthly said in a column about him, he was the skunk in the garden party. I never really understood if that was because of how uncomfortable he made somebody feel or how he looked.
Lee Rood is an investigative reporter and Reader's Watchdog columnist at the Des Moines Register. There is more to her story. We will hear the rest in a moment. This hour, we're listening to The Inside Scoop, true stories told in front of a live audience on April 12th at an event sponsored by Investigate Midwest. This is Talk of Iowa from IPR News.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Talk of Iowa from IPR News. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we are listening to a collection of true stories told in front of a live audience in Iowa City on April 12th. The theme for the evening was The Inside Scoop, and all of the storytellers are journalists. The event is sponsored by Investigate Midwest, the Midwest Center for Investigative Reporting. Investigate Midwest is an underwriter of Iowa Public Radio. And just before the break, we were listening to a story told by Lee Rood. She's an investigative reporter and the Reader's Watchdog columnist at the Des Moines Register. Her story is called The Story Behind My Stories. It's about her dad, Mick Rood, who recently celebrated his 80th birthday. He won a Pulitzer Prize for his work at the Omaha Sun. Lee grew up in Omaha, but when her dad moved to D.C. to cover Congress, she and her brothers would spend the summers with him, often rubbing shoulders with his journalist friends.
In those days, reporters would work really long hours while Congress was in session, so my brothers and I would hop the subway and meet my dad and his friends after work. It was great. We were like little mascots in the newsroom, and all the reporters loved us, except they had this bureau chief who was very by the book. And this bureau chief didn't like the optics of kids hanging out in the newsroom, so he would type up these little rules that the reporters needed to obey. And one day, he banned having kids in the newsroom. Seriously annoyed, my father responded in his own way by cutting out a picture of a Spanish galleon and taping it to a seascape of a bad painting in the Newhouse News Service lobby. And then he took dead bugs and locust shells from his garden and placed them delicately on the silk flowers that adorned the front desk. In those days, journalists had wide access to politicians and covered everything that moved. They could stop into the offices of members of Congress by day and then play softball with their staffs at night. On the 4th of July, my dad and his friends would get to take us to watch the fireworks on the White House lawn. And on slow news days, he would take us out for donuts in the morning and then to hang out in the U.S. Capitol press room while he nosed around for news. We had our run of the neighborhood, and that neighborhood was Capitol Hill. I got my first job at State's News Service at the age of 12. My dad said his boss wanted to hire me, but I think he was a little nervous I was wandering too much. I was hanging out with homeless people and at the local liquor store where the owner, a former Red Sox catcher, would give me free root beer and hot dogs at lunchtime. I earned $200 that summer just sorting mail and sending news stories on a machine called a telecopier, and I was thrilled. It was more money than I'd ever seen in my entire life until my dad made me split it with my older brother, who was watching our kid brother all summer. After Dad shed the ponytail, he found himself a wife from Connecticut, and we got ourselves a little brother. Now something of an elder statesman in Washington in the 1980s, he became an officer in the National Press Club and would introduce important dignitaries, people like Boris Yeltsin or Nelson Mandela, at luncheons that were televised on C-SPAN. It was during this time that my brothers and I got to meet some interesting people, and also about the time that I started reading more than just the Washington Post style section and the cartoons in my dad's New Yorkers. When I finally got to college, I realized I already knew what I wanted to be. But after that first class, I never mentioned the Pulitzer or Summers in Washington. Where others might have felt journalism was their birthright, I felt somehow that I just wouldn't be able to deliver. Where my dad's generation was also defined by Watergate, mine took shape after the Cold War. My secret dream, had the professor asked, was to become a foreign correspondent. So I studied Russian and Russian history and international relations. But every summer, I would return to the East Coast, where I would work at news services or the Washington Post as a copy aide. In time, I learned journalism the way everyone does, by doing it again and again. I learned that the best journalists are more than just scribes or stenographers. They're people who want to report the news, people who want to tell you stories the public doesn't know but should. I learned that if you work hard enough and dig deep enough, every once in a blue moon, you can find enough information to set a prisoner free, to change a law, or to set something right. I learned that truth and sunlight are the only antidotes to lies and darkness. And I learned that studying Russian and Russian history isn't necessarily a bad thing, but its usefulness is definitely a matter of timing. While I pursued my career here in the Midwest, I never stopped following the careers of the people I grew up around. One became an editor of the New York Times. Another unraveled the Monica Lewinsky-Bill Clinton affair. One switched from business reporting to commentary and won a Pulitzer of his own. Okay, one left serious journalism to become the editor of the Weekly World News, but in his defense, he did make sure that there was one fact in every story. But it wasn't until the attacks on the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021, that my brothers and I had a real chance to reflect on what we'd learned growing up in Washington all those summers. On that day, we watched in horror as people scaled the Capitol, bashed in windows, terrorized Capitol Police, members of Congress, and their staffs. And it made us angry and very worried and very, very sad. But it also made us remember that we were lucky to grow up around some quirky, whip-smart, often hilarious people who dedicated their lives to reporting facts, finding truth, exposing corruption, and upholding the First Amendment. Over the last three decades, I've had a ringside seat watching some amazing journalists here in the Midwest. Some are with us tonight. I've tried to do my part, and on the good days, I tell myself I deserve a cape. I think all journalists do. Without the public support that the Fourth Estate used to enjoy, journalism is less of a sacred calling to many, but not to me. I've worried a lot over the last decade that my job is going the way of school librarians or Walmart cashiers. We've endured massive layoffs while misinformation is everywhere. Distrust grows while reels rule the world. But I've been reading lately that journalism is becoming a popular major again at many universities. And I think that's amazing. And it gives me much needed hope. The story behind all my stories is you don't need to know what you're getting into, just as long as you do. Thank you.
Lee Rood is an investigative journalist and Reader's Watchdog columnist at the Des Moines Register. You're listening to The Inside Scoop, a storytelling event from Investigate Midwest on Talk of Iowa from IPR News.
Our fourth and final storyteller of the evening, Randy Evans, is here with a story called Norma Jean. Maybe not the Norma Jean you're thinking of. Randy Evans is the executive director of the Iowa Freedom of Information Council, and he'll share with us today the story of Norma Jean, a special performer he met while reporting in Iowa and Illinois, and one man's devotion that still bears testimony today.
I've been a professional journalist since high school. When I walked into the offices of the Bloomfield Democrat back in 1966 and talked the editor into hiring me, he gave me a sweetheart deal. I got to be a reporter and the newspaper's janitor. It was the only time in my career that I have truly cleaned up. I still remember my first byline. It was a feature story I wrote that summer on my interview with Myron Florin before he performed at the county fair. What? You don't recognize Myron Florin's name? He was a TV star, a big star, at least among the people who liked the Lawrence Welk show and polka music. You see, Myron was the featured accordion player for Lawrence Welk. Please don't start heading towards the door. My story tonight is not about a guy who entertained your parents and grandparents in the middle of the last century. I want to tell you about another person that you've never heard of. His name was Wade Malone. He was a retired druggist down in the little Mississippi River town of Oquaka, Illinois. It's just upriver from Burlington. I met Wade in 1976, shortly after the Des Moines Register broke the news to me that I was going to be moving to Davenport to become the Register's reporter there. Wade was a respected businessman in Oquaka, which is a town of about 1,400 people. Everyone in town knew him. He was someone who could get things done. He was also a guy who had kind of the marketing savvy of a P.T. Barnum. I drove down to Oquaka to meet Wade, and I quickly realized it was no secret in town that Wade had a girlfriend. She was a younger woman. Wade was 65 years old, and his girlfriend, Norma Jean, she was only 30 when their paths crossed. Wade and Norma Jean didn't spend a lot of time together, at least not in the beginning of their relationship. Fate has a way of doing that sometimes. You see, Norma Jean was a showgirl. She performed for people's enjoyment. Wade's affection for Norma Jean went beyond what you might expect for a man who was happily married to the sweet, charming, delightful Mary Malone. And Mary was quite understanding about her husband's feelings for this other woman. To be blunt, she had leathery skin, a nose that was long enough to be noticed, and let's be honest, she had a weight problem too. She probably had more of an eye for peanuts and apples than for the druggist who had a twinkle in his eyes. Sadly, by the time I met Wade, Norma Jean was only a memory. She had died a tragic death 4 years earlier. But Wade simply couldn't put this gal out of his mind who had come into his life and had stolen his heart. Norma Jean was one of the stars for the Clark and Walters Circus, which had come to Oquaka to perform in the city park. It was a small circus, a one elephant show, I guess you could say. And Norma Jean was the circus's premier pachyderm. On a summer day in 1972, several hours before the show was to go on, Norma Jean was standing under a tree in the park when a storm moved through. Lightning struck the tree, the jolt from the bolt carried down the tree trunk, through the chain that tethered her to the tree, and snuffed out Norma Jean's life, and her show business career too. The circus packed up and left town, leaving Norma Jean, all 6,500 pounds of her, on her side under the tree, and leaving the folks in Oquaka to ponder how in the world they were going to dispose of this really big star. Finally, a backhoe was brought in to dig a 12-foot deep grave right there in the city park. They rolled Norma Jean over into the grave, filled the hole, and everyone moved on with their lives, everyone except Wade Malone. It was a month or so later that he realized he still had feelings for Norma Jean. As he told me, "I would drive by that grave on my way home, and I noticed that nothing had been done there. It was just an old grave." So Wade planted grass. He placed a small plywood marker on the grave. He erected a little white picket fence around the plot. He put flowers on the grave, and each Memorial Day for years, he gathered up the unsold wreaths at the local grocery store and placed them on the grave in memory of Norma Jean. But Wade thought the old girl, that's what he called her, the old girl, he thought that she deserved to have a nicer marker than the little plywood sign. He told me, when Norma Jean got it, that was the end of the show for the circus. The guy lost his business, and it was tough on the elephant, too. First, there was that little plywood marker, hand-lettered to read Norma Jean Elephant, 1942, died July 17, 1972. But Wade thought a big star needed a better marker, and it should be larger than life, just like Norma Jean. He began talking up the need for the town to do right by the girl. In time, his coaxing and cajoling connected with the people in town and around the Midwest, too. They came to recognize that Wade Malone's heart was as big as Norma Jean's. In time, he raised about $800 for a proper tombstone for the star, who was struck down literally right there in their midst. He explained his obsession, and here's the money quote. "If you can't go through life helping people, even if it's an old dead elephant, then there's no use being here." Finally, on the eve of Memorial Day in 1977, 5 years after Norma Jean was zapped, the new tombstone was ready to be dedicated. Believe me, it's impressive. It's 8 feet tall. It's 12 feet wide. It's handmade from slabs of fieldstone with a granite insert, a glassed-in display case that will tell you about Norma Jean's career, and there's a concrete elephant standing proudly atop the marker. Wade even arranged for another elephant to attend the dedication. During the ceremony, this visitor named Oka carried a large wreath of daisies in her trunk and gently placed it on Norma Jean's grave. Oka then perched her front feet up on the stone monument, flapped her big elephant ears, lifted her trunk, and trumpeted loudly. It was a touching tribute, and several hundred people applauded wildly. I don't want Donald Trump to accuse me of being a biased reporter. There was some embarrassing news that day in Oquaka. Oka rudely left an unplanned surprise on Norma Jean's grave. Some organic matter. But the day was wonderful, and Wade summed it up like this. "Everyone was so darn nice. It gives you a warm feeling in this cold world. I think we did her proud." I find that visiting Oquaka refreshes me. It reminds me of the town where I grew up. It reminds me that people are basically good. It reminds me that we are all here on this earth, as they would say in show business, for a limited engagement. So we should make the best of every day that we have. And on each trip to Oquaka, I always think of Wade Malone and his advice from oh so many years ago. If you can't go through life helping people, even if it's an old dead elephant, then there's no use being here. Thank you.
Randy Evans is a longtime journalist and executive director of the Iowa Freedom of Information Council. The event was sponsored by Investigate Midwest, the Midwest Center for Investigative Reporting, and organized by the Foundations of Event Management class at the University of Iowa. Thank you to audio engineer Jim Davies and producer Samantha McIntosh. This is Talk of Iowa from IPR News. I'm Charity Nebbie.